Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
He was willing to fight in the struggle, and he was willing to get in good trouble.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Just a couple of hours ago, the nation said its final farewell to the late John Lewis. The music you're hearing is a special song written for Lewis by B.B. Winan and sung by B.B. and his brother Marvin called Good Trouble, which closed out the funeral service held at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta earlier today. Considered by many to have been the conscience of the Congress and a lion in the fight for civil rights, a host of national speakers, including three former U.S. presidents, paid tribute during the ceremony. In his eulogy, President Obama said that Lewis, as much as anyone in our history, helped the nation stride towards its highest ideals.
And someday when we do finish that long journey towards freedom, when we do form a more perfect union, whether it's years from now or decades or even if it takes another two centuries, John Lewis will be a founding father of that fuller, fairer, better America.
Since Lewis's passing, we have talked here on Radio Boston about his place in history, the importance of the work he did, and how that work will be carried on by the next generation of young leaders. But today, for this final farewell, we focus on John Lewis, the man. We spoke with Shirley Small Rougeau and her son Vincent Rougeau, whose family life was intertwined with Lewis's in the pursuit of social justice. Shirley is now retired and living in Weston, Massachusetts, and Vincent is the dean of the Boston College Law School. And I started by asking Shirley how she first met John.
I was living in Miami, and two other friends of mine who worked for SNCC and CORE came to Miami to attend a voter registration conference teaching us how to do these voter registration drives. And John was among them, with David Dennis and Henry Thomas, better known as Hank. And I just, met him briefly at that meeting. But because I was involved with CORE, with Vincent's father, I, communicated back and forth, or we were in touch with those who were working in Mississippi and Alabama.
And when you say CORE, do you mean the Congress of Racial Equity?
Of Racial Equality, yes.
What was your first impression when you met him?
I was blown away because he was so serious among those other young men and women who were SNCC people. And I think the group of CORE volunteers and workers were slightly older, as I am 1 year older than John. So, but they were all kind of happy-go-lucky, very serious about their work, but John was thoughtful, incisive about whatever he was doing, and almost always ended up charging the group with doing something. Let's not just sit around shooting the bobo, as we would call it. Let's do something. And, when we were together in Atlanta or wherever, he said, let's go downtown and march on Riches or something. Let's do something.
Vince, were you a young person when you met him? I understand you babysat for his son at one point. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I guess I probably met him, as a preschool-aged child when my parents were living in Atlanta. But I don't remember that. I probably remember meeting him for the first time when we moved to Washington, D.C., or the Washington, D.C. area. And so that would have been in the, mid to late 70s. 75 is when we moved there. So I probably met him right around that time. And yeah, I started babysitting for his son one summer shortly after that. It was probably, I was probably like a ninth grade mom or something like that.
Yes.
Shirley, when I was younger, we used to play a game sometimes that was, if you could go back in history at any point and, meet a person or have lunch with a person, who would it be? And I was thinking about that today, and I was wondering, he's a legend and was understood as a legend in his lifetime. But when you met him and in those early days, did you have a sense of him being legendary?
Well, not in a sense of his being legendary, but I just knew upon meeting him at first and knowing his history of, you know, having had been involved in the sit-ins that when he was a student, I was a student as well. And I just knew he was going to be a great leader of his peers. I didn't know, and as you've probably heard, he was not a great speaker. You know, he had a lisp and he had problems pronouncing certain words, but whatever he said even then was so powerful. He always emoted. He always said something very significant.
You know, these were all really highly educated, polished people, you know, with master's degrees and PhDs, a lot of them over time. So, you know, I think they were very hard on themselves in terms of the standards that they imposed on one another. So I think what Mom just described is a great example of that. It's not that he wasn't a great speaker. It was just that they had very high expectations of each other, and they would quickly identify ways that people should improve, and, you know, or areas where they weren't at their best in terms of this or that thing. But I think what Mom said was right. I mean, his emotional power was clear to everybody, despite whatever, you know, sort of polish he might have lacked from time to time.
Vince, what did it mean for you to grow up in that environment and around such luminaries with such exacting standards and strong vision for the future?
Well, you know, obviously when I was a child, I probably didn't realize just what a gift I was being given to be around these people all the time. You know, it's sort of like, in some senses, you know, civil rights was the family business, and you don't always appreciate the things that you're, you know, surrounded by. And sometimes it seemed like a lot, you know, maybe not, I wouldn't say a burden, but, you know, expectations were high, and our parents had done extraordinary things. And continue to do extraordinary things. Just, you know, they were often trailblazers, you know, first at so many things, you know, or we'd be the first, you know, Black family in a suburban neighborhood. I mean, we were always trailblazing, and sometimes it was exhausting. But being around all of these folks and listening to them over time, particularly as I got older, I became very much aware of the fact that I was in the presence of something very, very special, and to be able to learn from these people and to see how they, you know, moved the nation through their perseverance and their ability to focus on a goal and to hold themselves, as we said, to very high standards and to press forward, became something that, you know, I started to model my own life on over time.
You lost a friend, Shirley. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
How have you been feeling?
I have been both devastated emotionally, but so proud, because I believe that he was given the honor that he deserved, and he would be proud to know. Now, he was not one who looked for adulation, or he was just plain John, and he didn't ever get concerned about himself. It was always about, well, what are you doing, and where's this one? He'd always ask me about the children and things like that. But I think that I feel so proud that people have come from all over the country and even over the world to pay tribute to John. And I just, you know, we're all going to miss him. But I think that I have a special, special place that is just empty now. It's empty, and I know it will be fulfilled at some point. It'll fill. But right now, I just feel empty.
When I've lost somebody I really care about, I think back to the feelings in those days and weeks after, and there's usually both some anger and some real gratitude. Is there anything you're angry about now in the wake of John Lewis's death, and is there anything you're particularly grateful for?
Well, I'm grateful that John Lewis lived. And I'm grateful that he lived the life that he did. I'm extremely grateful that he left such a legacy for the young people and those who are even coming behind the young people who are in the streets of today. And I'm very angry about those persons to higher heights, but yet are unwilling to do those things that they know would be the right thing to do. That angers me very much. But someone said to me, a friend, oh, I understand why John Lewis is so angry, but Vince knows John was not angry. Passionate, yes, but angry, no, he was not angry. So I am trying to teach myself to mitigate this anger and rage that I feel because people are not being honest about their feelings in terms of what John Lewis stood for.
And what would your message to young people now be, Shirley?
My message would be the same as John's. First of all, to show love most of all, but in all you do, if you see something, say something. Stand up and do something. Most of all, please vote, 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 because that's what John spent most of his life working toward, the ability for all people to vote. And that I want to add as well. John was not just about any particular race of people, people of color, black people. John loved all people, and he wanted all people to be able to live in this society with the rights and responsibilities that we all have.
That was Shirley Small Rougeau, a close friend of John Lewis, now retired and living in Weston, Massachusetts, and her son, Vincent Rougeau, the dean of Boston College Law School. Shortly before his passing, John Lewis wrote an essay that he asked the New York Times to publish on the day of his funeral. You can find a link to that essay on our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. And we're going to go out today with a little more music from Congressman Lewis's funeral service. This is Jennifer Holliday singing Take My Hand, Precious Lord. Precious.